you very much.
I think that fits my definition of dilettante. Except for the walking on water parts.
Minister, if I'm that pays off. Friends, colleagues.
I want to congratulate the organizers, first of all, because I think it's very fitting that a conference or a meeting of this sort, with this topic, can't take place without a whole lot of cooperation. In my case, it took Sean Malk renting a car. It took several people at the hotel trying to figure out how everybody would actually get here. Three of us in the car read the map and still got lost. Some of the local people drew on their body of local knowledge to give us directions, and we all ended up here. We wouldn't have been here, though, if we tried to do it on our own. At least I speak for myself in that regard. I know you should never start a presentation with an apology, but I have to make two apologies. One is that I'm suffering from a terrible cold, which I gather several of you are as well, so I don't feel so badly about that now. I thought that's why the table suddenly vacated a moment ago. I actually was quite nervous. I wasn't sure which was more dangerous, whether calling Penny a day or two before this to say I didn't think I was going to be able to make it, or getting on a plane and coughing. Do you know what happens now when you sneeze in public? People look at you as though you should be carrying one of those bells that lepers had in the Middle Ages. And I'm the wrong generation. I know I'm told regularly, daily, almost hourly, to sneeze in my sleeve. We didn't do that. I mean, I think it's a good thing, and I'm glad young people are being encouraged to do that, but I can't get there fast enough. So, I mean, I use my hands, but then I don't know what to do with my hands afterwards. And this, I think you probably have noticed, this is becoming a new social conundrum. We have enough social conundrums, but this is another one. Shake or not shake? Well, in Europe, they're doing this, which here might be interpreted as some sort of First Nations greeting, I suppose. There's a lot of elbow bumping. There's a bit of the Obama fist bump. It's just one more thing that you have to... You know, in Quebec, we have this problem about which language do I speak first, which can lead Anglophones to speak quite a long time in French before they realize, wait a second, you did say your name was Smith. Anyway, that's one apology. The other apology, en second lieu, je m'excuse auprès de mes amis francophones parce que je vais faire ma présentation en anglais. Et je le regrette, mais il faut dire que mon cerveau n'est pas assez clair pour que je m'exprime convenablement. But any questions, of course, I'll be happy to take in English or French. When Penny asked me to come and speak, or the organizer, I shouldn't put it all on Penny, shouldn't put all the blame on Penny, asked me to come and talk, I thought perhaps the theme would be on not letting a crisis go to waste, which, of course, is a reference to the famous comment by Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff in the White House, who said, you'd never want to let a crisis go to waste. Well, we've had a crisis. In fact, a week ago, we marked the first anniversary. It's been called a variety of things, the crisis of the collapse of credits, or the bank failures, or the real estate implosion. What was it? Well, really, I think we've all seen what underlay that. There was too much risk that people didn't understand. There was too much leveraging. And at bottom, too much doing what everyone was being rewarded to do, which was chase profit at all costs. And I guess it resulted in a sort of mass delusion that some peculiar alchemy of human ingenuity, complex mathematical formulae, and sophisticated technology had somehow taken us into an era of endless prosperity, endless wealth, endless growth.
Now, the initial response, of course, for the crisis was basically to try and fix the financial system, stabilize the markets and banks, get credit flowing again, inject stimulus money to prevent what we were told was the threat of a second Great Depression. And we've had a flood of commentary in the last week, 2 weeks, largely the effect that it's worse. The recession is over. The market is back. Credit is flowing. Barrick is making deals. And Canada is splitting itself in two. Today I read that Dollarama is having an IPO. So this is good news. Deals can be made, bonuses are reinstated, and we're encouraged to believe, especially in Canada, that it wasn't so bad after all. I think you've all seen the tagline on the government-paid advertisement on television, which essentially is, we're coming out of this stronger than ever. Does anyone believe this? There's much, much more than that, obviously. And I think we need to disentangle some of the longer-term trends that were underway long before last year's crisis from the short-term impacts of the crisis itself. In the latter category, one of the most significant ones, I would say, is the dismantling of the G8 as the so-called executive committee managing the global economy. And its replacement by the G20. Now, again, the rise of the BRIC countries was happening a long time ago. The phenomenal growth many of them have known has been underway for several years. So that's not so much the cause of this as the moral decline, I would say, of the United States. The collapse of credibility of the so-called Washington consensus, i.e., limited governments, unfettered markets. Maybe we can also hope that last year's crisis dealt a blow to what has been called autistic economics. You must have heard this expression. It started in France among students of economics who characterized the way they were taught as being autistic in the sense that economics was divorced from any sense of social reality. And that notion of, not just a notion, that revolt against the way economics was being taught spread from France to Cambridge University and then across the Atlantic to the United States. However, there's a much more important underlying phenomenon, a trend that I think to some extent was obscured by the relative prosperity that so many of the industrialized countries have enjoyed for the last 10 years, which is a major shift in the structure of our economies. Now, one aspect, of course, is the slow birth of the so-called green economy. The restructuring that we're beginning to go through, some countries, particularly in Europe, much further advanced than we are, to be much more energy efficient, less wasteful, replacing mass production by more customized products, distributed networks, and with consumers becoming what Alvin Toffler already 10 years ago referred to as prosumers. In other words, where the line between producer and consumer is being blurred. As I say, this is much further advanced in some countries, and I think in Canada in particular we're lagging behind. Partly that's because we have such a heavy investment in conventional energy. And partly, I would say, because we have a desperate lack of leadership. Leadership in the business community and leadership in the political realm. And I say now, out of deference to the minister and what he just told us, I'd be more specific and say the federal political realm. So bailing out dinosaurs like GM and Chrysler still seems to make more sense and have more appeal and making sure that a technology company like Nortel remains intact and in Canada. Another trend which I would point to, which again is predates the crisis of last year, is the impact of the rising cost of energy. I don't know how many of you have read Jeff Rubin's book, why your world is going to get a whole lot smaller. But he points out that the rising, the inevitably rising cost of oil is going to overturn the rationale for much of offshore production. In fact, it may well throw the whole process of globalization that we have thought was kind of inevitable and fixed into reverse. It's going to make a lot more economic sense for countries and communities to turn to local sources to manufacture particularly low-value items and for the production of food. It simply won't make sense for toys to be made cheaply in China and then shipped across the Pacific at vast expense. In fact, the interesting implication may well be that, unlike what we have been led to believe, which is that we would graduate into a knowledge economy and we would offshore the production of manufactured goods, and particularly goods that are highly polluting, dangerous, we may find that the production of low-value goods comes back. And it's the knowledge economy, which, of course, is infinitely mobile and can exist anywhere with almost no cost of transportation. The last trend I would mention is the aging of our population. As we know, the balance of people who are in the workforce compared to those who are retiring is tilting. Fewer people are going to be paying taxes to sustain the pensions and the health benefits that aging boomers will require. And the implications of this are profound. When we look at the debts that are now being run up, the deficits, which the latest indication from the Minister of Finance at the federal level is $55 million, but that probably will be revised upwards. Most of the provinces are running deficits as well. The implications of that growing level of debt on the government's capacity to provide the services that we think we're entitled to are very significant. And that's particularly true to vulnerable or scattered populations, isolated populations. We saw what happened in the 90s when the federal government tackled its debt problem and the impact that that had on communities, on voluntary organizations, and indeed on provincial governments and municipal authorities. Canadians, in fact, have not been very enthusiastic savers for their retirements. It's surprising how few make use of RRSPs. And a significant number of Canadians have no employer pension plans. So healthcare and care more generally to people, whether they be elderly or children or people with disabilities or special needs, is going to become a key area for employment growth. So, taken together, I would say that we're moving in the direction of an economy which is going to be characterized by a shift from export-driven growth, particularly relying on American consumers, to more production for local markets, move from unregulated flows of capital to much greater monitoring and efforts to regulate. That's an ongoing battle, as you know. A shift from global supply chains to more local sourcing, at least where that's feasible. The whole range of new products and processes that will arise from the greening of the economy. A more determined effort to use local resources for local investment purposes. And perhaps overall, might one dare to hope that the goal of economic growth, as end in itself, will be replaced by a concern for a better quality of life. Now, obviously changes don't happen seamlessly or according to a plan. The institutions and forms that we've inherited from the old industrial economy will persist. I'm not talking just about corporations and bureaucracies. I'm talking also of schools, universities, those institutions delivering health care, political parties. All of these remain compartmentalized, hierarchical, centralized, professionalized. We deliver standardized services to clients or customers, not citizens or partners. All characteristics that we reject in our personal interactions, or at least we recognize these as being profoundly out of step with our needs and the preferred methods we have of operating. Attitudes are slow to change. Institutions are even slower to change. What we see now is a kind of passive resistance. Schools don't meet our needs. Kids drop out. Political parties no longer function in a way that most Canadians respond to. We stop voting. That kind of passive resistance can only serve us for a relatively short period. Of course, we're seeing efforts now to innovate. They're most evident, perhaps, in the private sector, where companies are reconfiguring their workplaces. They're trying to encourage greater creativity, greater engagement by their employees. They are, in many cases, developing whole new business models. Governments are struggling to innovate. But governments in Canada, at least, are really hobbled. They're hobbled by a sense of risk aversion, really a culture of risk aversion, which I think has been, in part, the result, probably unintentional, of the Auditor General's reports, exacerbated by the deep suspicion that many politicians are now expressing, and again, I'm referring perhaps mostly to the federal level, the deep suspicion politicians harbor towards the public service. And the sheer scale of government makes innovation difficult. The way in which it's organized absolutely parallel the kind of structures that we're talking about having to fundamentally change. What about the community sector? Well, I think it can be argued that it's actually in the community that most innovation takes place. We had a whole list of examples already provided tonight. Social purpose businesses, alternative energy co-ops, new ways to deliver services to vulnerable populations. In short, a very dynamic social economy. And I have to say, I was actually blown away by what the minister said, the portrait in Nova Scotia. I had no idea that there were so many organizations, so many forms of enterprise, so many people actively engaged in the social economy. But it's not recognized. Even the term in English, social economy, would leave most people puzzled. And it certainly isn't taken seriously, except in Quebec, by business leaders and politicians, who often are ignorant of it or dismissive. And we have to change that. I want to tell you about a trip that we organized in March of this year to the United Kingdom to give people a chance. These were a group of people who were drawn from governments, federal governments, British Columbia governments, some business leaders, some foundation people. We wanted to expose them to what was happening in the UK. Because when Tony Blair came to power, he concluded pretty quickly that the problems facing the United Kingdom were simply too great for the government to address on its own. He felt that unless the government could enlist the private sector and the community sector, or what he calls the third sector, there was simply no chance of having any breakthroughs in terms of the challenges facing Britain. Now, obviously, working with the private sector is straightforward. They have the resources, they have the skills, they have the capital. But trying to work with the community sector was something else altogether. It was going to require a massive effort on the part of government to build up an infrastructure and a capacity in the community sector for them to be able to part. The first thing he did was establish within the Prime Minister's office an office of the third sector. In other words, putting right at the heart of government people who understood and could speak for the capacity of communities. Then he undertook a whole series of measures to build institutions and infrastructure. He set up a task force led by a very prominent, very successful venture capitalist called Sir Ronald Cohen to make recommendations as to how capital could be mobilized in support of initiatives and innovations taking place in the community. And what emerged out of that were a set of quite remarkable institutions that we were able to visit and speak with. First of all, to provide capital for entrepreneurs, seed capital, an organization called Unlimited. Loans and equity for charities, an organization called Venturesome was set up with £100 million endowment. A fund was created, a venture capital fund called Bridges Venture, which would focus on deprived areas or environmental businesses. Initially funded 50-50 by government and the private sector, each putting in £20 million. That was the Ventures 1 fund. 2 years later, the Ventures 2 fund was capitalized at the level of £75 million, entirely private capital. An institution called Triodos, which provides equity and loan capital for social entrepreneurs. Future Builders, which provide loans and grants that are provided by governments, which is now managing a £100 million social enterprise fund. So all of these together created an ecology which was designed to ensure that anybody or any organization with a new idea, a fresh approach, could have access to the skills, the capital, the training, the networks of mentors and advisors and consultants, which would help them launch their idea, test it, and then take it to a scale that has significant impact. And the only criterion was that in every case there had to be a blended return that was both financial and social. In fact, Britain, as you probably know, has created the new legal structure of PICs, Community Interest Companies. Since 2005, when the KICs were instituted, over 2,800 have been registered in the UK. And more recently, the United States is moving in the same direction with the L3Cs, or Low Profit Limited Liability Companies. And of course, one of the first acts of the Obama administration was to create an Office of Social Innovation right in the White House itself. So really, when you look at these, you have to conclude that it's we in Canada who are out of step. We're the ones who are lagging behind. We're seemingly locked in this paradigm where business, government, the community sector all operate in their own ways independently. With, of course, the community sector very much as a junior partner. It's not quite as straightforward as that, of course. You see lots of businesses now talking about social being socially responsible. Governments are experimenting with PPPs, public-private partnerships. Community organizations are, in some cases, setting up social enterprises, certainly trying to be much more innovative in terms of generating resources for them to carry out their functions. But it's, and foundations, I might add, are beginning to look finally at mission-based investing and program-related investing. But it's a very slow uphill struggle. The challenge we face is we have to accelerate the process. We have to encourage more innovation. We have to create institutions and processes which will support innovation in the same way that the U.S. and the U.K. have done. And we have to do this urgently because of what I mentioned earlier, the underlying trends, which taken together do not taint a picture of effortless prosperity for Canada. On the contrary,
Let's take just one aspect. For a long time, we've had a policy of supporting a lot of people we call vulnerable for a variety of reasons outside what you might call the productive economy. It's what we say we can afford as an affluent country. So people who are unemployment or people who are disadvantaged or disabled or whatever have services provided to them. Well, when you look at the range of people who fit in these categories as so-called disadvantaged people, you find something like 3.7 million people with moderate to severe mental illness, which cost the Canadian economy about $51 billion. There are 430,000 seniors now living with dementia, and that figure is projected to grow quite dramatically. We have currently an unemployment rate of 8.7%, approximately 1.7 million people who are out of work. We have somewhere between 150,000 and 200,000 homeless people. 42% of adults have a low literacy rate. What this adds up to is the most astonishing squandering of human potential. I'm not arguing that we shouldn't be generous to people who need our help. I'm saying that most of those people are not asking to be provided with services by government or welfare agencies. No one wants to be isolated. Nobody wants to be treated as marginal. Most of them would like to be fully participating, contributing members of the community. In other words, citizens. The problem is not what holds them back. The problem is that we're not prepared to make the often small adjustments that are required to allow them to participate fully. It's easier to simply design a service to keep them in the role of client. My contention is this is not going to be possible in the future. We will either allow these people to be truly marginalized, isolated, without access to the services they need, or we will find ways to help them become engaged citizens. It'll impose a burden on employers. Hiring people who have a manageable disability is not perhaps as efficient as hiring somebody who's fully abled. But some employers do it. And their conclusion is that the contribution to the workplace in some cases is greater than employees who seem to be more fully able to. I want to come down the list. People don't choose to have a low level of literacy so that they can live their lives in unemployment insurance or in low-skilled jobs. So this is a challenge that we face, I think, as a society, but it's one which particularly applies to those of us who are focusing on social economy. Because really, when you look at the characteristics that I've described of this new economy which is emerging, what is it? It's a social economy. It's driven by a new environmental and social consciousness. It looks for ways to both engage and satisfy the needs of people at risk if being ignored or poorly served by the market or the state. But we have to accelerate this shift. We need better data. That's where the research comes in. We need a much stronger public image. Even the term social economy, as I said earlier, seems marginalized. People just aren't aware of the scope and scale. Probably we need a private sector champion like Sir Ronald Cohen in the UK. Somebody who actually can tell attention. So far, we haven't been able to achieve it on our own. We need to create the infrastructure for building capacity and involvement. Institutions like the PDC in Quebec. We need this right across the country. But I would say that above all,
we need a new narrative. We need to replace the story that's offered by what I've called autistic economics. In other words, growth is the panacea that solves all problems. By a more textured story. One that better reflects the reality of people search for fulfillments, relationships, happiness, not just money, not just profit. And perhaps part of creating that new narrative is represented by the effort to displace GDP, sometimes referred to as goddamn productivity, by something which actually reflects a much more holistic understanding. Roy Romano is leading one such effort, the Canadian Index of Well-Being. There's extraordinary research being done by John Halliwell and Alexander Haslam in British Columbia. But we have to get that GDP off the front page and the TSE index off the third item in every newscast in order to shift people's thinking away from growth as the end and purpose of human life. Something that's more balanced, more social. Now, some of this is beginning to happen. There are institutions like Causeway, which is promoting the social finance agenda, developing an advocacy strategy, working very, very carefully with governments across the country, and trying to get through to CEOs of the big banks, the investment funds, the financial institutions, help them understand that just as in the UK, the private sector has come to understand that the social economy is actually a viable place to invest money. Another initiative is the Social Innovation Generation, which is a partnership of the Foundation and Mars Center in Toronto at the University of Waterloo, and PLAN, a community organization based in Vancouver. Again, trying to take the extraordinary wealth of innovative ideas and approaches to defining communities across the country and give them profile. Let me close just by saying leadership has been defined as the courage to see reality as it is, to see possibility when others can't see it, and to inspire people to move from reality to possibility. The reality for many of us is that classical economic theory is just an ideology. Perhaps it's the economic version of the infamous end of history that was prematurely proclaimed by Francis Fukuyama a decade ago. And furthermore, it's an ideology that has led us down a blind alley. The current economic crisis is targeted with enough people. Not enough people yet, but it's a start. Other possibilities do exist. We've heard of some of them. New ways of creating employment, creating economic opportunity in ways which contribute to environmental and social sustainability, which advance human well-being. These are being created. Our task, your task, through research, through policy change, and especially through innovation in every sector and at every level, we have to inspire people. We have to inspire people from what too many think is reality, not to be challenged. Common sense, conventional thinking, the infinitely more creative range of possibilities that we know exist, that in many ways we're involved in supporting and promoting. And if we can succeed in this, then I think what we need is a decade from now, we'll be able to say, l'économie industrielle est morte, vive l'économie sociale.